delighted to welcome John Danaher, whose work I've drawn upon extensively during my research. He has a phenomenally interesting career. We're going to dive more into that and explore his book, Automation in Utopia, some of his papers that he's written. I believe he is he's hard to pin down. I'm not sure if he's a techno-optimist or a techno-pessimist. We'll discuss some of that. But one thing I know for sure is that he's probably doesn't like technological determinism. So we're going to discuss work, technology, and everything in between. Thank you, John, for taking time out for us. Tell us a bit about yourself. How would you like to be introduced?
First of all, thanks for inviting me to participate in the podcast. I am an academic. I work in a law school in Ireland, and I do research on primarily on the ethical, social, and legal implications of technology. I have a diverse set of interests, though, I would say. Like, I'm not, although that's my primary area of research, I do think about and write about a number of other topics. So, for example, I have a blog called Philosophical Disquisitions, and on that blog, I've written about pretty much every philosophical topic you can imagine, and some kind of more scientific topics and some kind of advice for people looking at careers in academia, some stuff on how to teach and educate. So I don't like to be sort of pinned down into one particular box.
Yeah, disciplinary chauvinism is something I learned about, and I think you sort of transcend that quite beautifully. I don't think you studied philosophy, but you became a philosopher. Did you always wanted to become one?
I wouldn't ever make the mistake of defining myself as a philosopher, because I think philosophers might dislike that. So I've never done a course in philosophy. I've never acquired a degree in philosophy. It's true to say that most of my academic publications are in philosophy journals or philosophy adjacent journals. So maybe in some practical sense, I am a philosopher. But you know, there would be significant gaps in my knowledge in comparison to somebody who had taken a typical academic pathway in philosophy, like doing undergraduate and postgraduate and PhD program. Did I always want to be what I'm doing? Not really. I suppose when I was younger, I had no fixed conception of what I would be. Sociologically, it's probably important to bear in mind that I grew up in Ireland in the kind of 80s and 90s. Most people of my generation would be first generation students in university. It was not the norm for people to attend universities. Neither of my parents attended university. Both of them started working when they were 18 years old. So I didn't have any sort of sense of there being a career trajectory in academia. I didn't know what that pathway even looked like. That's something that I stumbled upon in later years. So I was relatively aimless, I would guess, as a teenager. I studied law in university because I thought it would keep options open for me later in life, that if I wanted to go down like a practitioner route and work as a lawyer, I could do that. People with law degrees are also valued in some other industries, management consulting or public service industries as well. So it seemed like a useful way of keeping my options open. But as I proceeded through my undergraduate degree, I found myself more and more interested in questions around the theory of government, moral and political ideas that are adjacent to law and intersect with aspects of law quite a lot. And I just decided to pursue more studies in that area. And I luckily stumbled into an academic career in that area as well.
So would it be safe to say you love your job, but you critique work?
I don't think it is possible to say that I love my job. That'd be an overstatement. There are aspects of my job that I like. So the things that I like most about what I do are the autonomy and independence that I have to, I've significant amounts of free time that I can fill with whatever it is that I would like to do, whatever research projects I would like to pursue. I am fortunate in one sense that I've never been subordinate to somebody else's research agenda. I've always had the opportunity to define that for myself. You know, I've never been part of a group that has a specific project or output that they have to produce. You know, as with most jobs, there are aspects of it that you end up finding maybe frustrating over time. Since I work in universities are large bureaucracies, and there are many frustrating aspects of working for large institutional bureaucracies, particularly ones that have been around for a very long time, and sometimes have very strange norms of and ways in which they operate, or limit opportunities in certain ways. I can also talk about this if you like in more detail, but I do also find certain aspects of teaching frustrating, which is obviously a significant part of my job. I've written about this extensively in the past. It's one of the things I've written about on my website. I like teaching, just to be clear, and I think it's very useful from my perspective in terms of understanding topics, and many times there can be positive interactions with students, and you get to sort of develop and mentor people, which can be a productive and valuable interaction. But there are other aspects of it that I think are less positive.
Cool. So you've written about the ethics of career choice. Do you want to talk to us about what prompted your interest in that particular article, and then we'll move towards your book, Automation and Utopia?
So a few years ago, I was toying with the idea of writing a book about the ethics of academia. So what I meant by that was like the ethical choices or decisions that are faced by academics in their working lives, you know, divided roughly into the three main branches of a typical academic career: you've research, teaching, and broader contribution to the administration, management of whatever institution you are part of. And there are ethical dilemmas and conundrums that face academics in each of those areas. So I was interested in writing about that more generally. And obviously a precursor or first step in that is to think about, you know, whether one should become an academic in the first place, whether that is an ethical career choice. And this is a topic that has acquired a particular interest in, I mean, maybe the last kind of 15 years or so. You know, some of the influence of this may be waning, because the ethics of career choice has become a major focus in the effective altruism movement, which obviously you would be familiar with, emanating out of Oxford. You have an organization like 80,000 Hours, which some listeners might be familiar with, which gives very extensive advice to people on ethical career choice. Some of that emanates, I should say, from philosophical debates about the ethics of career choice, most notably perhaps associated with the work of a guy called Bernard Williams, who wrote about the ethics of career choice in the context of, you know, somewhat esoteric philosophical debates about utilitarianism versus other kind of normative theories. I wrote a bit about that. I mean, there's two ways of thinking about the ethics of career choice, I would say. One is in a kind of straightforward consequentialist sense, you know, which career will do the most good in the world. And the other one is a non-consequentialist way of thinking about it, and maybe more focused on building your own sort of individual virtue or your own attributes. I refer to this as the self-actualization route. So is becoming an academic ethical from either of those perspectives was the focus in that article that I wrote. And I mean, the answer to the question is that in the consequentialist sense, it probably isn't, although it's not necessarily much worse than other career choices in that sense. It's very hard to actually figure out whether the career that you choose does a lot of good in the world. And from the self-actualization route, it can be an ethical choice, but obviously that's dependent on your own sort of unique mix of attributes and skills.
So lots of people on network capital, about 200,000 of them are young professionals. They are constantly thinking about what to do with their lives and how to make most of a difference with their work, how to achieve more, how to be more. But there isn't sort of a clear-cut framework. There are some self-help books. But philosophically, you do a phenomenal job of explaining how the philosophical lens, like utilitarianism, can be applied to measure career choices. Do you think that we've become like an achievement obsessed culture? Like in your university, when you teach students, your other researchers, even you, has work made us all obsessed with achievement?
It's a difficult question to answer insofar as I suspect that some interest or obsession with achievement has always been part of human life. I mean, my general framework for thinking about human life is that there are many things that humans value and pursue, and I think achievement is one aspect of that. Achievement can take on many different guises. You can achieve things, in your hobbies, your sports. You can achieve things in your family or personal life. You can also achieve things in work. I think the way I would reframe the question is whether in the modern world we have focused on work and paid employment specifically, I should say, as being the location or the forum in which most achievement gets done. Maybe that's a bad thing if we kind of block ourselves off from or close off these other ways of achieving things in life or living a good life more generally. So, I mean, that said, if you want to like a more specific question or specific answer to the question, I think there are aspects of modern work environments that do make us output oriented in work, that the way in which we measure success is focused on the outputs that we produce, and less on the processes that we follow. Like some of that is a function of knowledge work. It can be quite ambiguous or difficult to measure like what it is you ought to be doing. And so there's a lot of disagreement about like what the correct measure of achievement or success is, which can create different forms of obsession with different metrics of success. I can only, I suppose, really comment on this meaningfully in the academic context because that's the working environment that I'm most familiar with. But yeah, like you do see an increasing obsession with metrics, external metrics of achievement in academia, whether that is, the amount of articles you've published, the amount of research funding you have won or acquired, the number of citations you receive, and the number of social media posts that you achieve. And focusing on those sorts of external measures of success or achievement, sometimes that can be a positive thing, but sometimes it can be a negative thing because oftentimes we don't have a lot of control over the external measures themselves. I mean, just to give one trivial illustration of this, if I was concerned about like how often my work is cited by other scholars, like in some sense I don't have any control over that. Whether they cite me is up to them. All I can really focus on is writing the best articles that I can and trying to promote them or put them before people as ideas to be considered. Whether they are ultimately cited a lot and I get a high H index, like a measure of my influence in academia, is really beyond my control.
True. You've written a paper on achievement and how AI might influence that. So, do you think as large language models, other kinds of productivity softwares become enmeshed in all aspects of our lives, our sense of achievement or fulfillment is going to be diluted? People will derive much less success from their work, from their careers, and so forth.
Yeah, I think it's a concern, a risk for sure. So, I mean, this is a paper that I wrote with actually, I think a former guest on your podcast,
Yeah, Sven. Yeah.
Sven Nyholm, Automation Work and the Achievement Gap. I mean, in essence, like that paper is about the fact that there's a big kind of philosophical and legal debate about the impact of autonomous systems, AI systems in the world. And one of the concerns is that they give rise to so-called responsibility gaps, which means that, you know, humans create these machines in some sense, but then the machines do things on their own without direct input or supervision of humans. So who's responsible for the outputs of the machine? Okay, if you know, the self-driving software in a Tesla car causes a fatal collision, is the company responsible for that? Or is the driver in some sense responsible for that because they failed to heed warning lights or something like this? These are questions that arise about responsibility gaps. So a lot of the focus on responsibility gaps is negative in nature. It's looking at a blame for bad outcomes. But there's also an interesting inverted side of that is like, who gets praised for positive outcomes? Do the engineers that created AlphaGo, the Go playing software from DeepMind, do they get part of the sort of achievement of that program beating the world champion? Probably not really. I mean, in most of his reaction to it is that they don't think that the engineers are great Go players or anything, that they successfully defeated the world champion. It's more that, you know, we created a software system that managed to do it. But the humans they can't claim to be the world champion in Go, if you know what I mean. But there's a responsibility gap in that direction, in the positive direction, which in the paper that with Sven we refer to as the achievement gap, that humans no longer achieve these positive outputs because there's an intervening causal agent, the machine. And yeah, I mean, I do think the increasing use of AI systems in workplaces, particularly autonomous AI systems that don't require immediate or ongoing supervision or control of humans, does pose a threat to achievement, that it will give rise to these achievement gaps. And I think, you know, that's intuitive enough. If a student writes an essay for one of my courses using a generative AI system, whereby the AI system has produced most of the content, then I think it's reasonable to say that whatever grade you might assign to the essay, it's not a grade that the student themselves deserved. Now, I mean, there are difficult questions that arise because there's a question to be asked about, like, how iterative or interactive is the process between the human and the AI? And so there could be contexts in which the achievement can be meaningfully linked to the human input. But there are plenty of contexts in which that causal link will break down as a result of AI.
So I believe that you talk about one in which AI does all the work, the other in which the human does some work, but is largely AI. And the third is where there's a good balance, where say the AI serves as a research assistant and the human draws upon whatever he or she wants and puts forward a research paper. So in the third case, where you find the human AI collaborations, which is balanced, do you feel that that might enhance the overall good in the world, might still give the human immense satisfaction and make the relationship much more balanced?
There's two distinct questions there. One is like whether the use of the system will increase the overall level of good in the world, consequentially speaking. Let's tie that to something specific. If you use, let's say, generative AI in writing research papers in biomedical science, will that lead to more breakthroughs in, you know, finding effective drug treatments or something like that? That might be the best illustration, by the way, since, you know, breakthrough drug treatments will require experimental testing as well. So I don't know, maybe like theoretical physics or something like this, you could think of as an alternative context. It could be the case that using the AI system generates more knowledge, you know, proves more theories or generates more interesting theoretical insights, and that could be a net gain for society. And so that could be a positive reason or a reason to use these systems. That is, I think, distinct from the question about whether the human that participates in that activity has any and a meaningful control over or input into that output. And like, I suppose the one question that you could pose or consider is like, let's say you had two contexts, like one in which you have the AI producing the research or the insights entirely on its own, and one in which there's a human AI team. Does the human AI team produce better overall outputs? Or does the AI by itself produce better overall outputs? You know, if it's the case that the human AI team produces better overall outputs, then there's a reason to retain that. And that could be positive in terms of the human having some meaningful contribution to the output. But if the machine on its own produces better overall outputs, then a serious question has to be asked about the trade-off between human contribution and human achievement and the overall sort of consequential virtues of the system. I should say, like, you know, debates of this sort have kind of arisen in other contexts where you have machines controlling or being better than humans at certain activities. The most obvious one would be something like chess, where, you know, computers have been able to beat humans at chess for a long period of time. There was a period of time when human-machine collaborations could beat machines on their own, but that's sort of now in the past. It's now the case that machines can beat even human-machine collaborations. And you can imagine a similar situation arising with AI in the workplace as well.
Yeah. I wrote a book called Passion Economy and the Side Hustle Revolution, where I take a relatively more techno-optimist view of the world of work. The new kinds of jobs will come up. Technology will perhaps free us up from the mundane tasks. And then I give a bunch of examples and case studies of how I see the passion economy proliferating. In your book, Automation and Utopia, you, I think, present a techno-cautious case. So could you give us a brief of what prompted you to explore this topic, and what's your main thesis in the book? And then we can explore some of the themes within it.
Yeah, so I mean, I wrote that book, I guess nearly, you know, 7 or 8 years ago at this stage, in terms of when I actually wrote it. It was published in 2019, should be 5 years ago. So I probably started writing it 7 years ago. At that point in time, there was a lot of interest and debate about technological unemployment, about advances in AI replacing more and more tasks that were performed by humans in the workplace. And at, you know, most of the literature was focused on what you might call like the standard economic analysis of that phenomenon. Like, would it lead to widespread unemployment? And how do you compensate for the loss of income that could result from such wide scale unemployment? And this sort of led into debates about reforming taxation or social welfare systems in order to spread the gains of technological abundance more equally or fairly. And this, you know, at this point in time, you would have had people like Bill Gates commenting favorably on introducing something like a basic income policy, and many other sort of leaders in the tech industry doing the same thing.
Right.
There's the other side of that debate, which at the point in time that I started writing was relatively more neglected, was what I would call like the debate about meaningfulness or human flourishing, is that whether work played some sort of positive role in the meaning that people derived from their lives, that it gave them a sense of value, a sense of purpose. And if you took work away from them, there would be this crisis of meaning as a result. There'd be a kind of vacuum left in people's lives, irrespective of their loss of income, which might be compensated in other ways. There would be the loss of value or purpose, which might be harder to compensate for. On the flip side, there were people who would argue that this was a good thing, because actually, you know, work is drudgery, it's unpleasant for most people most of the time, and freeing up people so that they could pursue other interests in life would be a positive thing. It would be kind of a leisure economy various slogans employed for this, like fully automated luxury communism, being one maybe memorable phrase. And so that there's a positive side to that. So the book that I wrote, Automation Utopia, was a contribution to that second debate about the crisis of meaning arising from technological unemployment. And I mean, in the book, I made four main claims, which are outlined in the book and split across the two sections of the book. So the first part of the book is called Automation, and the second part of the book is called Utopia. So in the first part of the book, I argued that the automation of work and work-related tasks is both possible and desirable, but the automation of life more generally could be quite a negative thing, could have a number of negative consequences for human meaning and flourishing. And in the second half of the book, I looked at two different sort of visions of the human machine future, which I grouped under kind of broadly defined headings, namely the cyborg possibility or the virtual possibility. So the cyborg future is one in which humans become more like machines, and the virtual future is one in which humans retreat from the world of work and we pursue a kind of leisure life, a life of play or games and all that. And I argued that the first of those visions, the cyborg vision, was probably not desirable and not achievable within any sort of meaningful time frame or relevant human time frame. And then that the second possibility, even though on the face of it sounds maybe dystopian or disquieting, actually had a number of virtues and could would be a positive future for humanity. So those are the four main claims in the book.
Yeah, and I draw upon them extensively in the papers that I have to write that I write. On network capital, a lot of our advice, or even the purpose of this podcast, is hopefully to nudge people to rethink some of their assumptions about work, do stuff that matters to them, basically love their job and do it well, and hopefully build a name for ourselves. You actually caution us against this point of view. You tell us that there are legitimate reasons to hate your job. Could you sort of expand on that? Maybe I'm not doing justice to your main argument.
I should say that like one thing I have often commented on in interviews about the book is that the book employs a deliberate strategy of what I would call like rhetorical hyperbole throughout. So there are times when I use maybe slightly inflammatory language or ways of phrasing things that provoke a response that are disquieting or disorienting. So yeah, the chapter of why you should hate your job, is quite provocative on the face of it, and like on one level, I wouldn't defend it in the sense that whether you like or dislike a job is really a matter for you to decide. It's your own emotional reaction to it, and I can't control that or change that in any meaningful sense. I guess the version of the claim that I would defend is that reflecting upon it more generally, individual jobs might be good or bad, and you might enjoy them or dislike them in various measures. But work as a whole, as a social phenomenon or social structure, has a number of problematic and negative features that maybe sometimes go underappreciated or under-recognized, and that there are perhaps alternative ways of deriving the values or goods that we associate with work. So the work is maybe in one level unnecessary. It's an unnecessary way of achieving these kind of positive things in life. And another part of that argument was that work is being made worse in many ways by sort of a combination of factors, the sort of economic system that we live in, and the technologies that are proliferating in work. So the chapter itself like outlines five different reasons why work is a bad thing, and I haven't actually refreshed my memory of the book, so I'm not going to actually remember all five of them perfectly. But the majority of them focus on issues around autonomy and choice, that work constrains people's autonomy and choice in various ways. work itself, which I should say, for purposes of clarity, I define as paid employment.
Right.
Work in the economic sense. There's a more general phenomenon of work is just, anything that requires exertion or effort that you do. So in some sense, lifting, if I go outside into my garden and I cut the grass in my garden, that's work, right? Because it's hard, it's difficult, and I'm moving objects relative to the surface of the earth or against a force. But it's not work in the sense that I'm interested in that particular chapter. A lot of that has to do with like choice, that contracts of employment limit our choices and options. It renders us subject to dominating influences, forces that limit our freedom in various ways. Either that's an employer who actually literally exerts a kind of dominance over you as an employee, or the market, more abstractly, that kind of exerts a kind of dominance over the choices that you make in life. You have to direct your talents in the direction that is rewarded by the market and not necessarily in the direction that is of most value to you or most interest to you. There is a problems nowadays with these sort of conditions of employment, that they're becoming more unpleasant and more subject to kind of limited non-pay related benefits. Which is a well-documented problem in terms of the gig economy and the fragmentation of work, more sorts of temporary, casual forms of employment, a phenomenon known as underemployment amongst economists, that people have to work several jobs just to make ends meet because of changing conditions of employment and fewer worker rights and things like that. And then there's also just an income distribution problem, which has been widely discussed in recent times, that there's been a significant hollowing out of the middle of the economy. Middle income, middle skilled jobs have largely gone away, which has resulted in a polarization of the workplace to two extremes. You kind of have one extreme of people who are very highly paid and well rewarded, usually very well educated, working in creative problem-solving jobs, and another segment of the economy working in typically more manual forms of work, which are less well rewarded. They're lower skilled forms of work in the economic sense. So again, just to be clear, to an economist, lower skills usually means like there are fewer barriers to entry to those forms of employment. You don't require the same level of education. That doesn't mean that the job isn't skilled. It could require a lot of skill to perform successfully. So there's a mismatch here between economic jargon and the vernacular. So you have those sort of income distribution problems, changes in conditions of employment that are negative, and freedom and autonomy problems that I think make work a bad thing. More technically, in the chapter, I refer to it as being structurally bad. That it exists within structures that are bad or getting worse for most people.
Most of the time, yes. So you wrote this book, published it 5 years back, wrote this maybe 7 years back. A lot has happened in the world of tech now. So the machine can do a lot of stuff that skilled professionals could do. And how strongly do you feel that your assumptions, your assertions hold true today? Or would you like to modify some of them? In 2024.
I mean, I was a cagey academic writing that book, so I hedged a lot of my comments in a certain way. So, for example, at no point in the book did I ever make a prediction about a future in which no one would work. I spoke predominantly about a future in which there's much less work. And when I talk about there being significant forms of technological unemployment, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but I think I defined that as something like, if less than 30% of the adult population works for a living, that's a big change from the world in which we currently live, even if there are still some people who work. But I didn't put a timeline on when that would happen. And I wouldn't do that because historically these timelines have always been proven incorrect. What I would say in the intervening years is that In some ways, I'm more convinced of the thesis about, you know, widespread automation of work being possible. And in other ways, I'm maybe less convinced of it. I'm more convinced of it in the sense that there obviously have been certain breakthroughs in the technology, particularly in the world of generative AI, large language models, multimodal models, that I didn't really see at the time. That, you know, the initial iterations of GPT were only just coming out around the time I published the book. So I didn't anticipate that or see that really. And they became more impressive than I would have expected more quickly. And, you know, how that actually pans out and affects work isn't entirely clear yet, but it's certainly having some effects on certainly the kinds of skills that employers are looking for. And I think we'll have some displacement effect in employment in certain in knowledge industries in the coming years. You know, I'm less convinced of certain other kinds of automation. Let's say, like autonomous vehicles, that was a major concern when I was writing and people talking about the impact of autonomous driving on the US economy, let's say, where you have millions of people employed in driving trucks around, delivering goods. It seems that that hasn't happened yet. And, you know, we haven't seen that major displacement of workers as a result of autonomous vehicles. Why hasn't that happened? Part of it is that, you know, the technology maybe isn't completely there yet or isn't as impressive as people were predicting it would be within a decade. I mean, but there's also, I think, a significant social and legal backlash against the technology that needs to be factored in here. And I actually wrote a paper on my blog once about why I think we'll never get to a world in which we have autonomous driving. And that's not necessarily because the technology is impossible, but rather that the legal and social incentives are such that it would never be in the interests of a company to actually claim to have a fully autonomous vehicle, because that would expose them to too much liability. It would always make sense for them to insist that whatever technology they have is a kind of collaborative system that requires some human oversight and input. And I think it's hard to completely eliminate those kinds of legal restrictions or incentives that might limit the rollout of the technology in certain ways. So yeah, I mean, some things have happened faster than I thought and have been more impressive than I thought, some things less impressive than I would have predicted at the time.
Fantastic. One of the things that I've been amazed by in your body of work and some other philosophers is your ability to write about very contemporary topics across genres, from work to sex robots to AI ethics principles. How do you manage to juggle your day in a way you're able to carve time for it? What's your, like, how do you divide your day, if at all you have some sort of system?
Yeah, I mean, I would say that there was a time when I was much better at doing this. I mean, personally, you know, the biggest thing that happened in recent years of my life is that I had two children, both, you know, so two kids, both under the age of five. The first one was actually born when the book came out, like, so literally when Automation Utopia came out, my first child was born a week later. Okay. And I remember I was invited to give a talk at the World AI Summit in Amsterdam. This is just an anecdote. Like 2 or 3 days after she came out of the hospital, and I went to it. I went to the talks. I thought it'd be, you know, a useful way of promoting the book. Very, you know, unfair on my wife in some ways. And she, but she wasn't. She was willing to sort of go along with that. And when I got to the conference, one of the ideas is that the conference would be a good way of selling the book as well. There's thousands of attendees. I can't remember, somewhere between 5 and 10,000 people attending that conference, and they'd be an ideal audience for purchasing copies of the book. So the publisher actually sent a big box of books to the Netherlands. The publisher is based in the US for sale at the conference. And the Dutch import or excise authorities refused to release the books to the conference, so they
Oh.
never showed up. There was no impact on sales. I remember Stuart Russell, some people might know, a well-known AI theorist, co-author of the most popular textbook on AI. He also published his book, Human Compatible, I think, at the time, and he was one of the keynote speakers at the conference. And I remember there being queues of people lining up to get their copies of his book signed by him. I'm not suggesting that I would ever have been in the same league as Stuart Russell, but there was nobody there to sign my book. Anyway, that's a complete anecdote and distraction from your main question. So the impact of that on my working life has been that it's been much more chaotic and constrained than it previously was. I mean, at the time that I wrote the book, you know, the typical working day would be that I would start quite early in the morning, like, you know, 7 a.m. maybe I would work. I'd write in my office at home or at the university for a couple of hours, maybe write between kind of 1 to 2,000 words a day, and then spend most of the rest of the day reading or engaging in other kinds of research-related activity. I mean, I am fairly like obsessive or focused on acquiring lots of different form types of information. I read very broadly. You know, on my desk around me as we speak, I have books about legal history, technology, the history of apartheid in South Africa. I have a book on that for some reason on my desk, and I have a book about effective altruism, sort of somewhat critical of it, the Penguin History of the World, Derek Parfit's Reasons and Persons. So these are all just immediately on my desk. These are things that I have been reading in the past week, and a papers on the history of the impact of technology on tort law as well. So, you know, I try to read very broadly and widely, and I pursue whatever my interests are. And that is positive in one sense that I never get bored. I'm always engaged in what it is that I'm reading. It's maybe negative in one sense that I'm not necessarily very focused on any one thing. So I flip about a lot from topic to topic. When I'm working on academic papers, I often flit about between them as well, but I don't necessarily focus on one at a time. So, you know, I'm sure there's ways in which I could be more efficient or productive as a scholar, but that doesn't really bother me too much. I just do whatever it is that interests me. So I at the moment it's relatively unstructured how I approach my day, apart from the fact that I spend a lot of my day reading, and you know, a significant chunk of the day, majority of the day as well, I should say, looking after my kids and things like that. So.
I saw a tweet on this subject about you, so I wanted to ask because most of us have to juggle so many priorities, and we're constantly looking for the system. But the system that you said you do whatever piques your interest, and you do it really well. But you're just like a prolific producer. I mean, just in the past, I want to say 3 or 4 months, you would have published a handful of books, many blog posts, many articles, done a few podcasts. This is very atypical of a philosopher. This is almost like a tech bro. So I see that you've combined several aspects of different jobs into one, and I think it's pretty admirable.
Yeah, again, to go back to one of the things that I value about an academic career is, again, that sense of sort of independence and autonomy that I can do whatever it is that I'm interested in. As long as I hit certain you know metrics, but as long as I publish some academic papers every year, and as long as I show up and teach my classes and correct student essays, for the most part, people leave me alone. So a lot of what I do is not directly rewarded by my institution, the people that I work for. So like for many years, I've written a blog. I've written, you know, well over 1,500 articles on that blog. I've slowed down a lot in recent years. Again, a large part of that is a function of family circumstances. But you know, none of that has really been of value from the perspective of my academic career, maybe indirectly or tangentially it is, insofar as it's a way that people learn about what I'm doing. It might be a way in which I get invited to conferences or events, something like that. But it's not something that I've ever cited or referred to, let's say, if I'm going for promotion or looking for other jobs, something like that. And it would be fairly widely discounted, I think, in the academic world. It's the same thing with like the podcast. So I've run my own podcast for quite a long time. And that has been, I think, positive in the sense of acquiring more knowledge or contacts in the academic world. And people do come up to me now and say that they, you know, first became interested in these topics because they happened to listen to my podcast, which is gratifying. But again, producing that podcast hasn't produced any obvious like financial gains or thing for me. It's just something I do because I happen to be interested in it. And I should mention as well, sorry, because in case I forget it, I said earlier on that I was thinking of writing a book about the ethics of academia, and that was how I got into the ethics of career choice. I never wrote that book in the end, but I did produce a podcast series that people are interested in called The Ethics of Academia, in which I interview 12 different people about these ethical dilemmas or questions. So yeah, you can find that online if you're interested.
We link your book and some of your papers and your podcast as we publish this. A lot of people sent us questions for this, so let me go through them one by one. So many people who are part of Network Capital identify themselves as chain makers. They want to create a positive difference in the world. Some of them also have been fans of effective altruism. Could you share your thoughts on the movement at large, and how might one think about EA and other structures along those lines?
Yeah, sure. So obviously EA is going through a bit of a public relations crisis in recent times, obviously with the downfall of Sam Bankman-Fried and his, as we are recording this, I think it's a week since he was sentenced to, I can't actually remember the full sentence, but it measured in decades.
Yeah.
I was going to say 25, but I couldn't remember exactly. And this has coincided as well with a couple of noteworthy critiques of effective altruism. Again, Wired magazine published a critique by a philosopher called Leif Vaynar, I think is his name, which is a no holds barred attack on effective altruism. What's my view? I mean, generally speaking, I would say I am favorably disposed towards the outlook of effective altruism, and I think the basic advice of like trying to do as much good as you can with your life is good advice, and to think about that maybe in somewhat counterintuitive ways, so that you don't necessarily follow the well-beaten or well-trodden pathway, but you think about it analytically, maybe using empirical evidence or data to figure out what the best choices to make in life are. I am fully on board with all of that. I think there's a few things I would say, and we probably don't have time to get into them in detail. I don't like the shift towards long-termism in the effective altruist movement. Even though I am interested in the future of humanity and it's a major focus of my own research, I think that that's a mistake to become overly fixated on long-termism, particularly in its stronger sense, although I know that the promoters of long-termism don't necessarily endorse it in its stronger sense. I think the older form of effective altruism, which was much more focused on development aid or development projects and the ways which they could be maximally impactful, was better. That said, I think there are important problems when it comes to measuring impact of certain interventions like mosquito nets or cash transfers. There are secondary unanticipated effects of those kinds of interventions that aren't always fully accounted for or appreciated. So these debates, these things are very tricky in practice. But broadly speaking, I'm in favor of the outlook or the ethos of the movement, as long as it remains reflective, open to criticism, and doesn't become a set of dogmas.
Thank you. We'll link to an article that I think you've shared on the subject. The next set of questions are on AI principles, AI ethics principles. Do you feel that many of these principles are just nice sounding words? Are they toothless? Do they contradict themselves at times? How might we think about principles as we develop new and sophisticated machines?
Yeah, I think the kind of proliferation of ethical principles for AI, you know, in some ways has been a good thing, you know, uniting people behind a common ethos or set of directions for the technology is a good thing. And there's a lot of consensus across the different statements of ethical principles, which shows that there is a reasonable degree of universality or unity to thinking about what the ethical approach should be. There are problems in translating those principles into practical guidance. You know, one obvious debate here would be something like fairness in outcomes. So what does fairness mean? There's a huge technical debate about how you have fair, unbiased algorithmic decision-making systems. And there are hard trade-offs to make there between different measures or understandings of fairness. And maybe we're not always explicit or clear about that translation problem. I do think that, you know, ethical principles by themselves can be relatively toothless without some sort of institutional and legal backing to support them. You know, let's say, give an example, medical ethics has been reasonably successful as a field or a discipline. And part of that is, you know, a willingness by medical institutions to take them on board and to really use them to guide their decision making. And part of that is also that they are backed up by and reinforced by legal standards. So I do think that's important if you want these principles to have a meaningful impact on outcomes. So in that sense, you know, the EU AI Act could be viewed as an important intervention here. We've yet to see what its effects are going to be, of course, but that would be a kind of major legislative framework that backs up some of these sort of ethical principles.
Awesome. And finally, there's a question from one of our members on sex robots. How should one think about the ethics of sex robots as it gets progressively harder for people to find companions where they live, if they achieve or if they give whoever's interested in them similar benefits? Are there ethical problems with the use of sex robots using AI for finding a date or having, say, an artificial girlfriend or a boyfriend or something of that sort?
I mean, it's going to be impossible for me to give like a soundbite answer to that question, since I have dedicated perhaps too much of my time to looking at the ethical issues around companion robots and sex robots. That was a major focus of my, particularly my earlier academic work, culminating in this edited collection that I published in 2017 now, so quite dated. I mean, generally speaking, like, I am in favor of people having the right to choose to do what they like, as long as they're not causing any harm to other people. And in that sense, you know, I don't have major opposition to the technology, and I think it could be useful for some people to find certain forms of companionship or intimacy with machines. And, you know, there's a whole subculture community of people online who claim or profess to be in love with dolls, realistic dolls, and some people view that as a kind of disorder, or what psychologists would call like a paraphilia. It's a pathological form of the expression of kind of intimacy or love, and I don't necessarily view it in those kind of negative ways. That said, I think there are some ethical concerns around the technology. I mean, the two major ones for me are obviously the creation of childlike sex dolls or sex robots, which I think is problematic. And I've written about this. You know, an argument for that is going to be, say, that it can effectively treat people with you know, attraction to children or something like this. It's a harmless way for them to express that desire vis-a-vis machines as opposed to actual human beings. I'm not convinced that it's likely to be a useful therapeutic intervention. But actually, more generally, I'm I think it's actually very hard to prove that in practice or establish that in practice. So I'm skeptical that we could ever get into a state where we know for with sufficient certainty that that is true. And I wrote a paper about that if people are interested. I think there are other things like, generally speaking, I think it's hard to prove that, violent video games or pornography have had negative impacts on real world behavior. These are very contested debates. So I think the same problem arises with sex robots. But even if we have uncertainty about that, there are reasons to think that the technology should try and reinforce positive norms of, sexual consent or sexual behavior, as opposed to being a sort of playground for violent fantasies. So that's just sort of two concerns I would have about
And we'll
technology.
link your paper for people who are interested in exploring this subject in more detail. Finally, John, is there anything that I should have asked you that I didn't, or any parting word of advice? And if you can just plug in, what are you most excited about for the coming year with respect to your own work or broader society or technology at large?
I can't think of anything that you should have asked me, or that I would have asked me. It's hard for me to get into that external mindset. What I would say is that what I'm working on now in my research is not so much on the ethical analysis of technology, but actually looking at how technology reshapes or changes ethical norms and beliefs. This has been a major project for a number of years. I've written a paper about the mechanisms of techno-moral change, outlining different ways in which technology affects social moral beliefs and attitudes. That is the backbone of a book that I'm working on. So that's the thing that I'm most excited about is working on that book.
Well, thank you, John. Really appreciate your time. And we hope to have you back. We'll link your podcast, your books, and papers so that people who are interested can watch on. But thanks again for doing what you do and helping us rethink our assumptions.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. I hope the answers I gave were somewhat coherent. They made sense to me when I was saying them, so hopefully they'll make sense to